Hello. I'm happy to be here, happy to be able to hold this little talk about the burden of proof. And I hope you have your outlines. It's kind of much, but I've been quite detailed. So I hope you don't have to take too many notes, but you have to fill in some things maybe. My feeling is this, that the burden of proof has become one of the most important arguments in the new atheist movement. It's like this. The discussion of the existence of God can easily end up in a kind of stalemate where arguments for and against the existence of God can appear to balance each other out, resulting in a draw. And I think this is unacceptable for a new generation of atheists. And they want to claim that theism is blatantly irrational, and for this purpose they turn to the issue of the burden of proof. It's become something of, if you read on new atheist websites, I get the feeling anyway that it's like, yeah, but we have the burden of proof. So it doesn't matter how the discussion about the existence of God goes, because we have this last ace to play, so to speak. That's the role of the argument, as I've noticed, anyway. And here is some quotes from the internet that will just illustrate this. The first one, you have it on your outlines. Thus, the burden of proof falls squarely on the believer. If the believer is unable to provide positive proofs for God's existence, the skeptic is justified in his atheism. Secondly, so who has the burden of proof and why? The burden of proof rests on the side making an assertion about the world. In the religious debate, one side is saying that there is some kind of God. The other side is arguing that the assertion of a God is not justified. The burden rests on the religious because they are making a statement they claim is a valid identification of reality. The atheist does not need to prove that a God is impossible. He only needs to show that the religious assertion is not justified. A third example, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. This is the way the real world and science works. When you say God exists, you are making an extraordinary claim, therefore the burden of proof is on you to back up your claim. A position that God doesn't exist is not a belief. That's interesting. It's not a belief. It's the standard position we all start out with until we're indoctrinated into religious schools of thought. People aren't born believing in Jesus. They start out atheist, lacking belief. There is no counterclaim necessary. Nobody has to prove the tooth fairy doesn't exist, either. Furthermore, it's technically impossible to prove a negative of this nature. I can no easier prove God doesn't exist than you can disprove my claim that I have an invisible, ethereal unicorn in the trunk of my car. I say I do. It's not my fault he disappears when you look there. Prove he isn't there. You can't. Okay, so this is just a little sample of what it can look like on the internet. So coupled with this idea of the burden of proof is this very common redefinition that we kind of saw a little bit off in this quotes too, a common redefinition of atheism. It says that atheism isn't a faith, but rather a lack of faith in God, and therefore it needs no defense. Here's a quote from a Swedish website that you don't have, I think, on your outline. To lack faith in God is no faith. It is the absence of faith. An absence of faith is the opposite of faith. With this definition, atheism withdraws itself from all burden of proof. Atheism is no faith that claims anything. An atheist doesn't have to have any beliefs whatsoever concerning God. According to this definition, the conclusion then is that the whole burden of proof rests with the theist, since the atheist has no belief that can be defended. Okay, that's like the introduction here. So let's go deeper into this. These kind of ideas comes, I think, from Bertrand Russell and Anthony Flew, basically. And Anthony Flew's paper, The Presumption of Atheism, I think is very influential here. And, of course, for a long time, Flew was one of the most important defenders of philosophical atheism until a couple of years ago that I think you're familiar with. He left atheism and became a kind of deist. Still, though, his contribution as an atheistic philosopher continues to influence new generations of atheists, I believe. And Flew makes this distinction in this paper between positive and negative atheism. Positive atheism makes the positive claim that God does not exist. Negative atheism, on the other hand, is mere absence of faith in God. The A in negative atheism is like the A in amoral or asymmetrical. This means that infants, and probably dogs and cats too, are negative atheists. Negative atheism is rather similar to agnosticism, but an agnostic might actually have beliefs about God. For instance, the belief that it's equally likely that God exists as it is that he doesn't exist. But a negative atheism, I think, should not even have that belief. So it's even less believing, so to speak, than an agnostic would do. And Flew claims that the burden of proof in the God debate is distributed in the same way as in a court. And I'll come back to this definition. Let me just say briefly what he says. And as you're well familiar with, the attorney, that's what it's called, attorney or the defense lawyer, yeah, has no burden of proof, while the prosecutor has the whole burden of proof. The defense does not have to prove innocence, but the prosecutor has to prove guilt. If the prosecutor fails to prove guilt, the accused is viewed as innocent. In the same way, atheism should be regarded as innocent until God's existence is proven, so to speak. So if the theist fails to prove God's existence, then it is rational not to believe in God. Okay, so that's the idea. Now, what should we say about this redefinition of atheism? I just want to cover that first and then go to the burden of proof. Well, the first thing that strikes me is that this redefinition seems to have a rhetorical function rather than appropriately express the actual conviction of atheists. I mean, it's hard to believe that atheists lack the positive belief that there is no God. You easily get the impression that this is a dishonest trick, actually, that the atheist is trying to pull, a kind of immunization strategy, basically, with the only purpose of withdrawing atheism from possible critique. A somewhat related observation is that it seems very difficult in practice to stick to negative atheism. I mean, let's say I'm on vacation in Scotland and that I've never heard of the Loch Ness Monster. I bump into a Loch Ness Monster believer who asks me what I think about the monster. After getting some information about the claim, then I answer this. Well, I'm not sure, but given what I know about lakes in general, I find it utterly implausible that this monster exists. And since I've not come across a credible witness of the monster, I end up in the conclusion that I don't believe that there is a monster. This seems to be a very rational answer. But let us say that my answer, but let us see what my answer would look like if I applied Flew's redefinition of atheism to it. Then I would answer something like this. Oh, I'm a Loch Nessist, and I lack all beliefs concerning the Loch Ness Monster, and therefore you have all the burden of proof. That's just ridiculous. I mean, it's like to pretend that you lack the positive belief in the non-existence of the monster. It's dishonest. And the same thing would be true of the atheist that tries to hide his positive atheism behind this kind of negative atheism. But, nevertheless, I don't think we have to attribute this dishonesty to Flew, necessarily. He starts his reasoning by saying that he is a negative atheist, not believing that God exists. But he concludes that positive atheism, believing that God does not exist, is very plausible. Why? Well, he seems to use this negative atheism as a rhetorical device to show that the theist has the burden of proof. And together with that argument, positive atheism gets rational justification. It's like this, like negative atheism plus the burden of proof argument equals a justification of positive atheism. I think that's kind of how you can generously, if you want to interpret it generously, you know, it's like, okay, it's a device, a rhetorical device. Even if some new atheists use Flew's redefinition in an intellectual dishonest way, I would like to make a more generous interpretation like this, just as I explained. The distinction between negative and positive atheism can function as a pedagogical device or strategy for pointing at the idea that the burden of proof ends up on the theist alone. If so, the redefinition of atheism can be justified by the same reasons that you would justify this unevenly distributed burden of proof. The redefinition would then simply be a way to highlight the atheist view of the burden of proof. If so, if we want to refute this new definition, or the function of it, so to speak, we should have to do that by criticizing the reason behind it, namely their view of the burden of proof. So let's look at that. And of course, I think I'm maybe too generous now, but it's better to be too generous, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Scott, yeah, you're always very generous. I remember that from your class. So I'm trying to learn here. Okay, so let's go into the burden of proof in the discussion about the burden of proof. Yes, because in different types of discussions, the distribution of the burden of proof will be different, right? You cannot just take for granted that a certain distribution is the right one. You must argue for it, correct? But that means that you have to have a meta-discussion about who has the burden of proof and why. But then the question arises of who has the burden of proof in that meta-discussion about the burden of proof, correct? So reasonably, the starting point must be that the burden of proof in that meta-discussion is evenly shared. Otherwise, we would need an argument in the meta-meta-discussion for why the burden of proof would be tilted one way or the other in the meta-discussion. Regardless of where we start, the first discussion must have an evenly distributed burden of proof. Let's go back to Flew's analogy with the court to see why that is the case, just as by way of illustration. If I claim that the burden of proof ends up on the prosecutor and not on the defense, I'm expected to give an argument for that, right? And the standard reason is the evaluation, that it would be worse if the court sentenced an innocent man to jail than setting a guilty man free. So, if we're not sure about someone's guilt, we want to err on the side of the innocent, so to speak. The innocent individual's right to be not to be punished is heavier than society's right to imprison someone in the hope that he is guilty, so to speak. Yeah, you get the point. This is an argument. This is an argument. And the fact that the unevenly distributed burden of proof must be justified in this way shows that the starting point in the meta-discussion is an evenly distributed burden of proof. The parties in the meta-discussion assumes, almost unconsciously and automatically, that the burden of proof is equally big on both parties. And if you say otherwise, you actually have the burden of proof to show why that is. So the person that claims an uneven distribution of the burden of proof has the burden of proof to prove that. So what is then the new atheist's proofs for that? And are these proofs or reasons good enough? I'm basically asking now, we take the court and we have this evaluation that it's better to not judge an innocent than to set a guilty man free. This is an argument. So what is the equivalent of that kind of argument in the discussion about the burden of proof? The atheists cannot just assume it. They have to give us some reasons. What are those reasons? Well, let's look at Flew's reason first. He would say that it's knowledge. He says that if we're asking about something as important as the existence of God, we should then require very strong reasons. Yes, even knowledge. Flew writes, then we should demand very strong, even knowledge. He writes this. It is in relationship to this unavoidable requirement for a ground for knowledge, that is, that it is justified to have atheism as our starting point. He says also, it would be scandalous to believe in God without evidence or even with insufficient evidence. Without such proof, one should be a negative atheist or an agnostic. Flew seems to mean that this in turn makes positive atheism more likely. There is much to be said here, of course. I mean, this is like open up the whole den of epistemological enigmas, kind of, or questions. So the question of, for instance, I mean, how strong our evidence has to be in order to give us a justified or warranted belief in God is as I said, a difficult and complicated one. What would count as evidence? Is religious experience evidence? How high up is the evidence bar set, so to speak? Must the proofs be philosophically conclusive or close to conclusive? Or is high probability enough? Do we need evidence that is rationally compelling for a skeptic or an atheist? Or is it enough with reasons that only are available for the theist herself? Must the believer in God be able to report all these reasons? Or is it enough that there are just reasons that are like that are available to the theist, or even maybe hidden to the theist? You know, it seems that you can know something without knowing that you know it, or without being able to report how you know it, and so on. So what does Flew require for something to count as knowledge? This is a huge discussion, and we cannot let Flew get away with a very narrow, probably very empiristic view of evidence. So, and William Wainwright has responded to this. He says something like this, that true beliefs, it's on your outline, true beliefs with good reasons but not enough to be called knowledge will have the same result as knowing that same belief. And such probable beliefs should not be dismissed out of hand. So even if we can't call it knowledge, if it's a belief with some good justification. Say, for instance, maybe I say, well, I think I know the way back to Budapest, and what I believe is actually true, and I have some reasons for it. You know, just because it seems kind of strange to say that I have the whole burden of proof in that situation. Anyhow, let me continue here. But even though if we grant Flew his right to demand a very high epistemic status of theism, we might wonder how that justifies his uneven distribution of the burden of proof. Why should not positive atheism be subjected to the same requirement? And why put negative atheism that lacks any beliefs about the God question against theism? It seems much more fair to put theism and positive atheism as opposites. You know, negative atheism is a kind of agnosticism. And let's say that I'm a moral agnostic. I don't believe in objective moral values, but neither do I believe in denying objective moral values. In a discussion about morality, Flew would seem to mean that I lack any burden of proof because I don't have any strong views about morality, and I make no claim on the issue. The one believing in objective morality then gets the whole burden of proof. But so would a person that would claim that there are no objective moral values. And how could one have a discussion with someone who believes neither claims? What's the point with such a discussion? You get my point? If someone doesn't have any beliefs, how can you have a discussion with that person? You know, it's like, that person doesn't... And of course, if you don't say anything, then of course you don't have a burden of proof. Then the whole burden of proof in that quote-unquote discussion will end up on the person saying something. But that's like trivial. It's trivial to say that the guy that is silent doesn't have burden of proof. Yeah, sure. What's the point? You know, that seems ridiculous, honestly. So, and with this redefinition of atheism, Flew make himself stand outside the discussion like the person without any opinion on the matter. But how can such a person participate in a discussion? One usually has discussions with people that claim things, right? Not with people that doesn't claim anything. So Flew's strategy seems so effective that it actually kills the whole discussion. So if you claim to lack any belief in the matter, then you surely put all the burden of proof on your opponent, but the prize is that you're not part of the discussion anymore. But in the moment you throw yourself into the conversation, you will do that by claiming something, and then you will assume the appropriate burden of proof for what you claim. You cannot be a full-fledged participant of a discussion and then demand that you will have that you will have as little burden of proof as the audience of the discussion. You can't have the cake and eat it. So the discussion about the existence of God will then reasonably be held by between the two positions that affirm and deny the existence of God. That is, between theism and positive atheism. And the only reasonable starting point in that discussion seems to be an evenly shared burden of proof. And actually, I think Flew would agree to that. I think so. But, well, he's dead now. I can't ask him. But given what he writes, it looks as if he's trying to avoid that by talking about the negative definition of atheism. But then one wonders why Flew thought that a discussion between theism and negative atheism is at all interesting. It is a trivial statement that the burden of proof is uneven in a discussion between one party that claims something and the other party that is silent. Well, anyhow, in the popular discussion, so let's leave Flew here and look at the popular discussion. I've run across three arguments for why the burden of proof ought to be tilted to the disadvantage of the theist. And those three are these. First, only positive existential claims can be proven, while negative existential claims cannot. Therefore, negative existential claims cannot have any burden of proof. The second one is, if you claim extraordinary things, you need extraordinary evidence. And the third one, if you claim that the world plus something exists, you have the burden of proof in relationship to the one who only claims that the world exists. Let's look at these three, and then there will be some application or more positive. I will try to explain what I do think is the thing that actually should distribute the burden of proof. So the first one, the burden of proof on the party that makes a positive existential claim. A common way of reasoning is that the burden of proof ends up on the one saying that something exists, while the person saying that something doesn't exist has no burden of proof whatsoever. Faith in God has been compared to faith in the Loch Ness Monster or the abominable snowman and things like that. If you claim such a being exists, then, of course, you have to prove it. The one denying such beings need not prove their non-existence. But is this correct reasoning? Can the burden of proof be tied to positive existential claims in this way? Maybe someone protests and say that it's easy to accept the burden of proof if you make the positive existential claim that there are no fish. And, oh yeah, let's, on your outline, that's the first claim then. If we can find good counter-arguments, then, of course, we have arguments against this argument. So the first one is, there is no fish in Loch Ness. So this is a positive existential claim, as you can see, claiming that there is... Sorry, it's an... there are no fish in Loch Ness. There should be R. Let's see here. I better just read. you can easily... so maybe someone protests and say that you easily can accept the burden of proof if you make the positive existential claim that there are fish in Loch Ness. You can easily prove it by catching a fish and hope that it wasn't the last fish in the lake, of course. It nevertheless shows that burden of proof is not determined according to whether the claim is a positive or negative existential claim. I mean, if you just switch the Loch Ness monster to fish, then you see how ridiculous it becomes. Okay, there is a Loch Ness monster. Yeah, then you have the burden of proof. If you say there are fish, it would be strange to say that you have the whole burden of proof. And the person denying that there is fish in the Loch Ness has no burden of proof. It's actually the opposite here. It's the person denying the existence of fish in Loch Ness that seems to have the whole, basically, burden of proof, or very heavy burden of proof, at least. The other one, second, there are no bacteria in this room. It's a negative existential claim that actually seemed to carry a heavy burden of proof. Here, the atheist could answer that that's a restricted negative existential claim and therefore it can carry a burden of proof, while general negative existential claims, like there is no God, cannot. You can actually prove this restricted claim, while a general negative claim cannot be proven, and therefore should be exempt from the burden of proof. But there are other examples. Look at the third one. There are no perpetual motion machines. Generally speaking, ever, never, there isn't any. This is a general existential claim that is negative and actually should carry a burden of proof. Actually, it has carried the burden of proof so successfully that it's been proven. So, isn't that a good example then of a negative general existential claim about reality that seems to have been proven, right? Another one, there are no married bachelors. So, it seems then that laws of nature and logic can actually help us prove general negative existential claims. But there are also other philosophical examples of general negative existential claims that seem to carry at least some burden of proof. For this one, for instance, there are no objective moral values. It seems strange, then, to use this atheistic argument on the burden of proof on this case. A moral realist claims that there are objective moral values. And that's a positive existential claim, it seems to me. An ethical non-cognitivist claims the opposite. But it would be strange to say that the moral realist has the whole burden of proof. That discussion cannot be won so easily by the non-cognitivist. Instead, both parties have the burden of proof to show why their ethical theory is the best. And I have another example here. There are no built-in rationality in nature. Of course, then, an atheist might say, yeah, but it's not an existential claim. It's a claim about properties, you know, and therefore they don't apply. But still, we can see that it's just not true that as soon as something is a negative existential claim, it has no burden or proof. The rule doesn't apply. There's too many examples, counterexamples. And let me just, it's not in your note, but let me give you another counterexample, because, I mean, you can have two kind of counterexamples. One, of course, is to show that there are negative existential claims that carry a burden of proof, some or the whole. But then you can actually show that there are some positive existential claims that some atheists believe in without them being proven. Let me give you one. I think this is kind of fun. Richard Dawkins, in his book, says that he actually believes there are UFOs. And I think that's funny. So, okay. So you believe there are UFOs. Why? Has it been proven? No. But he finds it likely, given his background knowledge. So he believes it because it's probable, not because it's proven. So suddenly he doesn't apply the rule that he glues onto us. He doesn't apply it to his own beliefs in UFOs, for instance. This is really I think it's a wonderful example of measuring with different measuring rods, something that the atheists have become experts in doing, I would say. And we have to, there are so many examples of that, actually. But here's yet another one. So, So I think we have good counterexamples to this rule, and they don't follow it themselves, so it's not a good argument. Now, let's look at the second one. Extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence. Here, the crucial question is, of course, what should be counted as extraordinary? Is it God's existence that is extraordinary, or is it positive atheistic belief in God's non-existence that is extraordinary? And also the beliefs that go together with that. So, for instance, the atheistic belief that the universe has come into being completely without any intelligent input and so on. So here we beg to differ, atheists and theists. Many believers would find atheism extraordinary. But we should grant that certain religious beliefs, like the belief that Jesus rose from the dead, is extraordinary. I think we have to just admit that. We have beliefs in our faith that are extraordinary, and therefore demand extraordinary evidence. But as Christians, we would claim that such evidence has been given, right? The reliability of the New Testament, the prophecies in the Old Testament, the persuasive attractiveness of the person and teaching of Jesus, the testimony of the Holy Spirit, can together make a sufficiently strong case for the extraordinary claim that Jesus rose from the dead. Atheists will for sure make another judgment here, but they have no right to bake in this judgment into the principle. A little bit like you argued. They're baking in their worldview in their principles, and we just have to keep them accountable for what they actually say. You hold to the principle then. You cannot bake in your worldview into it. Another relevant question is what is meant by evidence. Is it strong enough evidence for me to be rational in my Christian faith? Or does it have to reach the level of knowledge, for instance? Must the evidence be strong enough to convince an atheist? Must I be able to show the evidence, or is it enough that the justification is internal and so on? It's similar questions to the ones we asked before. In my experience of the new atheists, they have a tendency to raise the bar for evidence maximally high when they demand evidence from us, while they lower the bar for their own convictions. This, I think, illustrates an important point, namely that the term extraordinary is a relative term that is determined by my experience, my background knowledge, my worldview, etc. It is factors like those that determine my judgment on what seems extraordinary to me. That doesn't make truth relative, but it does make much of what we call rationality, good reasons, and reasonableness, and so on, relative to our background knowledge and worldview. Unfortunately, atheists are often blind to this, which makes them apply the principle of extraordinary evidence in a way that presupposes the naturalism that should be proven. Interestingly enough, this worldview blind application of this principle does not only make God extraordinary. Objective morality, the nature of consciousness, the validity of reason, free will, aesthetic judgments, among other things, things that many humans take for granted in ordinary life, seems to be quite extraordinary too, on the naturalistic view. Given a naturalistic view, which is the most natural thing to have if you're a positive atheist, all these phenomena appear as straight out fantastic, and they cannot be explained by or reduced to physical or naturalistic terms. I would argue that anyway, and I think there's a strong case for that. They are extraordinary given a naturalistic worldview, and would then require extraordinary evidence. But naturalism struggles to give such evidence. Why they remain unexplained, or often explained away, which is not an explanation. The problem for the naturalist is, however, that these phenomena seem to be more anchored in reality than naturalism itself. So paradoxically, it seems then that it is naturalism itself that turns out to be the extraordinary claim. And this, I say this just to illustrate the relativity of the term extraordinary. You see, we can easily tilt it and show that if you're a naturalist, there's a lot of natural phenomenon that seems natural in the sense that a lot of people believe in them, that seems extraordinary. It's not just God. So we can just turn the tables on them and say, well, actually, it's naturalism that is extraordinary. Anyhow, it really shows the relativity of that discussion, I would say. And you can't base, that's not a good argument then for the burden of proof. You have to find an argument that your opponent agrees on. Otherwise, you cannot assume that we will buy into this tilted burden of proof, right? Thirdly, the burden of proof is on the one who believes the world plus God. Here the idea is that both parties start with the belief that the world exists, but the theist believes in an additional entity, God, that exists beyond the world, so to speak. The atheist, on the other hand, believes only that what is included in the theistic belief, namely that the world exists. Therefore, the atheist has no burden of proof. What can we say about this reason for tilting the burden of proof? Firstly, I think we must ask about the scope of the discussion. What is the discussion about? Is the question, is there a God? Well, then, of course, the theist has a burden of proof. He gets a question, he has to answer it. But if the question instead is, what is it reasonable to believe about ultimate reality? Then it seems that everyone that gives an answer to that question should give his reasons. Then all parties have the same burden of proof, at least initially. Is it not more reasonable to put the question of God's existence into a broader discussion about the best explanation of the origin of the universe and life and so on? The God question should not be treated independently, I would say, of the alternative explanations. Surely one can narrow the discussion and only talk about God, but then we can also narrow our discussion and just talk about the reasons for a materialist or physicalist worldview without pulling God into the question. But why only discuss one alternative when the credibility of that alternative, at least in part, hinges upon the other alternatives we have and their credibility? Such a narrowing of the discussion seems to require special reasons, and it's hard to see what those reasons could be. So a narrowing of the discussion would be like asking whether Sweden has a good hockey team without comparing it to other teams. But isn't it not in comparison, in competition with other teams, that we best can answer how good a certain team is? So why should the God question be determined wholly without comparison with other answers or to ultimate reality? Furthermore, we must ask whether the atheist and the theist believe in the same world. Their disagreement is not only about God, but also about several different phenomena in the world. The question is not just the world plus God or only the world, but rather, what kind of world do we live in? Is this a world with objective moral values? Are there clear signs of design in this world or not? Is this a world that has been caused or not? Is this a world where certain events are best described as supernatural or not? Is this a world where human beings have religious experiences that can be explained naturalistically or not? And so on. These questions reveal that the theist and the atheist does not only disagree on God, but also that they have very different world views. It seems then that the atheist and the theist colors their views of the world. It is therefore quite naive to describe the discussion about God as if we agreed about the world, and therefore it's wrong to distribute the burden of proof accordingly. Okay, so that was those three arguments. And let me say something about Russell's teapot. That's another popular illustration about the burden of proof. And he says this: if I were to suggest that between the Earth and Mars, there is a china teapot revolving around the sun in an elliptical orbit, nobody would be able to disprove my assertion, provided I were careful to add that the teapot is too small to be revealed even by our most powerful telescopes. But if I were to go on to say that since my assertion cannot be disproved, it is intolerable presumption on the part of human reason to doubt it, I should rightly be thought to be talking nonsense. The idea, of course, is that the belief in God is like belief in this teapot. Without strong evidence, one should not believe in its existence. The burden of proof falls on the teapotist, while the ateapotist has nothing to prove. It would even be ridiculous to define our worldview out of your lack in faith of this teapot. Well, this is the same idea as the analogous to the Loch Ness and the abominable snowman and the relatively recent spaghetti monster and those things. With these analogies, belief in God is portrayed as odd, absurd, irrational, which makes the idea of a shared burden of proof unthinkable. There's much to say about this, but let me just give two observations. In these analogies, God is likened to a material object in the universe. But if God exists, God is the creator and the very foundation of existence, and therefore a radically different existence than material objects. It is therefore not very plausible to believe that we get knowledge about God in the same way or in a similar way as we get knowledge about material objects. So this is a very important disanalogy, I think. Secondly, Russell's teapot illustrates something important. Why is it that belief in God, that belief in the teapot feels so absurd? Well, is it not because we know quite a bit about teapots? Is it not because we know something about outer space and what kind of things that usually float around there? Right? Imagine that our background knowledge instead had been the following. And now, all the Brits, you I'll honor you here. We'll see what you say. The British Empire has just colonized outer space. And according to British tradition, the British royal astronauts have their afternoon tea in outer space. Why believe that small things like weightlessness should stop the Brits in their traditions, right? And on a regular basis, they dump their teapots and other tea-related attributes in space. If that was our background knowledge, I think the burden of proof would fall on Russell, right? And this brings us to the question of how the burden of proof should be solved. Well, it's just a little fun. So, the burden of proof is determined by background knowledge. As I show, the burden of proof is context dependent. And let me illustrate. When people prior to Copernicus saw the sun rise, they assumed that it was the sun that moved and that the ground stood still. The burden of proof was therefore on the one who claimed otherwise. Copernicus comes along and he assumes that burden of proof, and with Kepler's help some 200 years later, his theory succeeded to carry that burden. At that moment, the burden of proof shifted, since the heliocentric worldview became part of our background knowledge. If someone were to claim the old geocentric worldview, the whole burden of proof would fall on that person. In every discussion, we start somewhere. We have background knowledge about what usually exists in lakes or in space, or what phenomenon that is best explained by design, and how nature usually works, etc. It is this background knowledge which makes certain claims more surprising than others, and the most surprising claim should carry the whole or at least a heavier burden of proof. So let's think about that. What is our background knowledge in the question about God's existence? What are our expected starting points? Is it more surprising, given our background knowledge, to claim that God exists or to claim that he doesn't? The answer to that question is not as clear as the answer to the question about fishes, Loch Ness monsters, and celestial teapots. So as we've seen the theist and the atheist, are not only divided on the God issue, they have different worldviews and thereby different background knowledge to some degree and different expectations. So background knowledge is a great help, but I think we have to go a little deeper than that, actually. And I think the answer then is what I'm calling phenomenology. I'm not talking about Husserl's exact phenomenology. I'm just talking here about the appearing of things, how things appear in my experience. To describe the phenomenon is not to give an explanation of it, but only a first description of how the things seem to me. It is to be brutally honest with our experience of reality. And this, I think, is a good theoretical starting point, simply because it seems to be our real starting point for beliefs about reality. For the discussion to be fruitful, it is important that we try to give honest descriptions of how we experience things. There have been common ground there. I think we have common ground with our atheist friends. And such phenomenological descriptions can be our starting point in the meta-discussion about the burden of proof. Maybe the burden of proof falls on the theist sometimes and on the atheist at other times. So let's look at a few examples. So it's both phenomenology. We come to the phenomenon. And in the illustration with Copernicus, Stone Age people had the phenomenon. They saw the sun. It looks as if it moved. They formed that belief. Then, of course, Copernicus comes along, and he's looking at a lot of other observations, a lot of other seemings, so to speak. And then he put them together in a theory that explains a lot of things. And then that theory becomes part of our background knowledge. So it's both our background knowledge and our phenomenology that could be our starting point, together with the atheist, to determine how the burden of proof falls out. That's how I think it should be done. And let's just briefly go through then some arguments in the God discussion. Let's start with the design argument. It's interesting here, because even the very dogmatic atheist Richard Dawkins, in his book The Blind Watchmaker, I think it's in the first or second chapter, that he clearly states that life seems to be very designed. He even says it's overwhelming. The impression of design is overwhelming. And then he sets out to prove that it is only appearance. The interesting thing is that Dawkins seems to accept that the burden of proof rests on him when it comes to design. Phenomenology points strongly to design, and that becomes part of our background knowledge when we ask about God and design. This seems to be a natural starting point, but that means that Dawkins must show that completely natural processes, without any informational input, can explain the existence of life and design. And unless and until he has done so, we seem fully entitled to believe in design. And then, of course, he believes that he met that burden of proof. But then the question is, how much has he imported the naturalism into that proof? If we can show that his conclusion hinges upon naturalism, well, then he assumes what he was supposed to prove. And that's exactly what I think he does, by the way. So I think we have a strong case for design given phenomenology and background knowledge. Then look at the burden of proof when it comes to the cosmological arguments. It seems to me that issues about cosmology put a quite heavy burden of proof on the atheist. I mean, all our experience as humans tell us that events don't happen without a cause. That is part of our phenomenology. The Big Bang Theory is part of our background knowledge. From this follows the Kalam cosmological argument, for instance. It seems very plausible to believe that the universe has a cause and that that cause is something beyond the universe itself. The atheist must answer this question. Can anything come out of nothing? Why would cause and effect not apply to the universe as a whole? And so on. If the universe has a cause, why could that cause not be identical to the God of theism? However, the theist has also things to prove. Maybe most importantly, why believe that the cause of the universe is the God of theism or the God of the Bible? Nevertheless, it seems to me that the atheist has more to prove than the theist when it comes to cosmological arguments. Thirdly, the burden of proof and the moral argument. When it comes to the moral argument, I think you kind of get a draw, actually. It's trickier than the design argument and the cosmological argument. We can look at morality as a phenomenon and see that there are some universal components to morality, but there are also moral disagreements, of course. If different cultures and different times humans have viewed morality differently, well, then you can ask yourself, can you really build a common ground here? Can you really find a common ground with the atheist? And I think if you look at it, you will find some atheists with whom you can have a common ground. You will find some theists that wouldn't agree with that common ground. So it's kind of a mixed bag here. My judgment is that it's hard to find a general phenomenological starting point that will really work with all atheists, but maybe with some. And if so, then I think we have to go back to the starting point in the meta-discussion about the burden of proof, namely that the burden of proof is evenly divided. Fourthly, the burden of proof and the problem of evil. When we come to the problem of evil, it seems that we as theists and Christians have to carry a heavier burden of proof. If God is good and almighty, it seems strange that God would allow such evil things as the Holocaust and certain natural evils like earthquakes and tsunami floods where thousands or even hundreds of thousands of people die. In fact, the Bible itself expresses this sentiment in Psalm 13, for instance, and in the book of Job and so on. The burden of proof, then, seems to fall on the theist. Different religions will deal with the problem in different ways, but Christian faith, of course, will point at the cross and where God offers a solution to the problem of guilt and death for every individual and so on, and judgment day and so on. So we have some answering to do here. But even if the theist has more explaining to do, the atheist will not get off the hook, at least not completely. The atheist has to answer questions like these. If evil and suffering are so natural, why can't we get used to them? Why do we have universal values that aim to minimize and counteract evil and suffering? Why this universal sense of meaning with life, a meaning that evil and suffering threatens, if there is no objective meaning? Here, the atheist has also some explaining to do. So it seems to me that the burden of proof, you can kind of grade it to some degree, and we might have more, maybe. Well, okay, so here's the conclusion then. In this way, we can go through all the relevant arguments and questions and ask, what is the relevant phenomenology and background knowledge in light of which we can distribute the burden of proof? And it seems that the burden of proof sometimes falls heavier on the atheist and sometimes heavier on the theist. If so, it seems wisest not to proclaim a general burden of proof on one party only. We must look carefully into the situation, and then we see that the burden of proof must be decided case by case, argument for argument. When doing that, it seems to me that the atheist would carry a somewhat heavier burden of proof. But of course, if an atheist were to do the same exercise as I've just done, she would very likely weight things differently. But even if I'm right, it gives me no ground to put the whole burden of proof on most of it on the atheist. Because in doing so, I will only blur the insight that the different arguments in the God debate and the burden of proof in each of them has to be determined by the phenomenology and background knowledge relevant to that argument. The discussion about God's existence is too multifaceted and too important to be determined by a simple, one-sided, and rigged distribution of the burden of proof. Instead, let both parties carry the burden of proof relevant to the claims that are being made. Thank you. And now we have 5 minutes. Kill me, man, because suffering is the way you grow. Wasn't that what we learned earlier? Yes.
So I love this. Like I agree with I think everything you said, and I'm really encouraged by your work. I do have a couple of quick questions, though, with respect to the burden of proof and the example of the courtroom, right? So it does seem to me that the atheist is on trial when I am trying to evangelize him, okay? And he can say, okay, you need to meet these demands of the burden of proof. But what's unique, or at least one of the things that's unique about the so-called new atheism, is that they're the ones that are being evangelistic about their atheism, right? Yeah. So it seems to me that now I'm the one who's the defendant, and I need to say, give me all your proof. But it seems to me that because of the work of really brilliant apologists, most of the arguments they can muster, I have counter-arguments to and defeaters of, right? So that in light of all that, it seems to me that this really isn't an intellectual problem. Instead, what we have is really a problem of the will. And all of the counterexamples that you've given on page 5, I think when you give those to Dawkins, rather than him saying, you know what, that's a really good point, let me rethink all this, he's going to find some crazy story to tell that doesn't make sense to anybody, because he's not a philosopher, but we've heard that. So here's a place, you know, and I think that your whole philosophical argument here in this wonderful paper shows us that what we have here is at issue a theological problem of sin and not just an intellectual problem.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. This is a problem of the will, absolutely. And it feels like ridiculous to make this kind of paper arguing like this. In a sense, it's kind of, but it's used. It is influencing a lot of young.
Absolutely.
Young. So it just has to be out there, and that's my feeling. I think you're absolutely right. Bill.
I have a small constructive criticism first before I make a substantive comment. In your example in the Loch Ness Monster, when you first presented in the paper, I think you misspoke. You quoted the person who holds the rational position as saying, I don't believe that the Loch Ness Monster exists.
Yes.
But that's the negative atheism view. What you should have said is, I believe that the Loch Ness Monster doesn't exist.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that might be right. Yeah,
so
let me look into that.
The wording
yes.
Here's a more substantive comment. I thought what you said about Russell's teapot was just great, especially the relevance of background information determining how probable it is. But I kind of wonder if there is a confusion going on here between burden of proof issues and what Bayes' theorem would require evidentially for a conclusion to be proved. It seems to me that in these cases you're saying that someone whose belief is highly improbable on the background information, like the teapot, then has to address the likelihoods in Bayes' theorem. How probable is the evidence on my hypothesis compared to how probable the evidence would be on the negation of the hypothesis?
Yeah.
And in a sense, what you're saying is the person who has a highly improbable hypothesis on the background information has got to show, to counterbalance that, that the evidence on his hypothesis is much more likely than it would be on the negation of his hypothesis. And that looks like a burden of proof issue, but it's not really. It's just saying, to show your total evidence supports your view, you've got to address the probability of the evidence. And that's the problem with these Loch Ness Monster, abominable snowman examples, is that if the hypothesis is false, the evidence is exactly what we should expect to see with regard to the Loch Ness Monster. Mm-hmm. It's no lower. In fact, it's higher than if the hypothesis were true that we would have the evidence we do of the Loch Ness Monster. We'd expect to see, you know, carcasses of former monsters, photographs, sightings, and things like that. So do you think that, I just would lay that out to think about whether or not what one is really arguing here is sort of a case for Bayesianism rather than burden of proof issues.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I'm not very good at Bayes' theorem. I've tried to understand it, but it's kind of, But I think you're right. It's evaluations of the initial probability, and we will do that evaluation very differently, atheists and theists, and then an evaluation of the proofs, so to speak, the evidence, and these have to, counterbalance one another. The evidence has to be very strong if the initial probability is very low, and so on. Yeah, I think so too. Maybe the burden of proof can just be cashed out in those terms.
I was wondering about that at first, but then when you began drawing in all the phenomenology, that was a lot of the evidence, and if that can be put into the background information, what's going to go into the likelihoods?
But isn't that part?
Used them up.
But isn't that part of the evaluation of the initial probability? I mean, because there's a process where you evaluate that and you bring stuff into that evaluation.
Right.
It's not a neutral evaluation.
So you just have sort of appearances at first.
Yeah.
And then when you calculate the probability of E on your hypothesis, it gets a lot more sophisticated.
Yes, and if you want to convince your atheist friend about your evaluation of an initial probability, well, then you would have to appeal to something like phenomenology. You would say, but don't you experience it like this? I mean, wouldn't that be how you would go about to get the person on board on your evaluation? I think so. Yes?
Awesome talk and very stimulating. I have like 60 things to say. So
we can continue, yes.
The one is just I think maybe Dr. Craig just said it in a more sophisticated way, but I was confused by the... So you have the three arguments, the new atheist arguments, and the second one being extraordinary claims call for extraordinary evidence. That seemed to, in particular, that argument doesn't seem to me to be about burden of proof. At least, burden of proof is on the analogy of the court, where one side has to do everything and the other side doesn't have to do anything. There's still a burden on the atheist, in even if it's an extraordinary claim or whatever, to show that you don't have extraordinary evidence. Right?
There's
more that the theist has to do than he might have to do in some more ordinary sort of claim.
Well, but yes, couldn't you cash this out in this way, that the defense lawyer, the attorney, has a burden? It's not a burden of proof, but it is a burden, intellectual burden, to show that the proof doesn't work. You know, so there and here it will be a burden to prove that as an atheist then would cash it out like this. I think that it's such an extraordinary claim. So you need to score as a theist. You need to show that you're right, because the claim is very extraordinary. But of course, that's setting up the whole discussion, like a court, like saying you have the whole, because it's so extraordinary. So I'm just questioning then that setting up, the rigging of that, and saying, well, is it so extraordinary? What's extraordinary here? Isn't that parallel?
Maybe. I have to think more about proof, maybe, to clarify what you mean by that.
And I love to talk with you guys, because, as I said, I want critique on this paper. So I want all relevant comments to me.
On Peter's comments. This extraordinary evidence, or claims for extraordinary evidence, is, again, more about Bayesianism and probability theory, because you could refute the claim from the burden of proof issue by just saying, all right, ordinary claims require ordinary evidence.
Yes.
Right. So he hasn't justified saying he has no burden of proof. Even if he has an ordinary claim, it requires ordinary evidence.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that's correct. So maybe that's an argument not for shifting the whole burden of proof on the theist. It's an argument for shifting a heavy burden of proof on the theist. And they would say, I think you're right. Maybe it's not an argument for shifting the whole burden of proof, but maybe it's an argument for a lot of weight on our shoulders. Would that make sense?
I just think that as a paper, you know, especially if you want to influence atheism, it'd be really helpful to clarify. Maybe there's maybe different notions of burden of proof going on in this internet discussion, because people, you know, it's sort of we have a sense of what we mean, but we don't totally mean. So it might be worth just being clear
defining
about what you mean by burden of proof. And maybe if you can, and I'm not good at Bayesianism either, but do the work on the Bayesianism stuff and clarify where maybe this Bayesian issue is going on behind what the atheists are talking about, which they may not be aware of.
My initial guess is that Bayesianism is trying to just catch how we think about probabilities.
Yeah.
And but there's more going on here, because the atheist is front loading the issue, I think, in a certain way. Yeah, it's yes.
If we go into the direction of probability, we may get into trouble, because there we will have to talk about specific numbers, and they may be very difficult to provide concerning Loch Ness monster, because we need a space of well-defined events. It may be very difficult to describe it.
So yes.
It may be kind of dangerous direction to go.
Yeah. And of course, this is more of a defense. It's the atheist that is on the tack. I'm just saying that what you're trying to prove, the point you're trying to prove, that we have the whole burden of proof, is just not the case. And of course, I'm not trying to spell out how probabilities about these things should be done. Just that they are dead wrong. Isn't that enough for now? No, I'm just kidding. No. Yes. Yes, go for it.
Just some constructive stuff. Again, I really love the talk.
Yeah, sure.
So in the last bit where you go through this phenomenology, you know, I think just to say from my own region, consciousness is another interesting one. So even atheists, so this talk about the explanatory gap, and people realize that there's this great puzzle. So I would say that the burden of proof is very firmly on the naturalist.
Yeah.
To show that, and it goes back to your point about the worldview that we have. Actually, even just talking about what our views of the world are going to be very different in that earlier that you made. I think that they vary. It's as much the burden of proof to show that consciousness, which seems to be something distinct from the physical, is nothing more than the physical, as it is, and it's sort of like, you know, it's the burden of proof being on them to show that there's no fish in the. In the Loch Ness or whatever. I mean, that'd be one place where I'd say the burden of proof is very much.
Yes.
The other real quick comment is near the beginning with the discussion of flu and this negative atheism, it may not even be true that infants. Right, so we were having this discussion the other night at dinner about new psychological evidence that actually, there's some belief in God is somehow innate, or belief in supernatural agents or something behind.
Yeah.
Belief in design behind. Nature or something like that is perhaps innate. So it may not even be true that even if you're a savage from far, or you're an infant or whatever, and you never thought explicitly about the Christian God or something, that it may be that belief in the supernatural is innate in that way. So even that person wouldn't be an AI negative atheist.
No, it could be the case. Well, I think there's a lot of psychology going into this. There's a lot of how would you say. Psychology in the sense like this. When John Lennox was in Sweden, he debated the Richard Dawkins of Sweden, so to speak. His name is Christer. And in that discussion, at one point, the atheist, Christer, he says this, I don't have a belief system. And I just realized that him, I think he's representative of many new atheists. He has this picture. You have the religious house, you have the Muslim house, the Hindu house, and people have gone into this house and they are committed to it. But he is still outdoors. He has no commitment. He has no belief system. He's just viewing the things as they are. He's like a good old Christian fundamentalist that just read the Bible as it is. That's how he read reality. And it dawned on me that, like Socrates first thought, know yourself. If you don't know yourself, you don't know where you're standing. You have no map where you put yourself correctly. How in the world can you assess other people's positions and go into fruitful dialogue with them? You just can't. And this is what happens over and over again. You get this frustration because these atheists, they don't have a true view of themselves and what they're doing. And I think this could be a very helpful in apologetics, and say, but wait, and of course, I mean, to really pound that thing and say, oh, you have a belief system. Oh, yeah, you just said it now. Oh, yeah, but that's a belief. Oh, yeah, here's a conviction. Do you have proof of that? You know, just be a Socrates on them, I think that could be a good, because there's some kind of psychological blindness here, I believe. Yes.
Yeah, I think in this respect, Roy Clouse's The Myth of Religious Neutrality can help.
Yes, exactly.
To back that.
Yeah. And actually, your talk yesterday when you talked about the Italian scene, to me it just dawned on me that these Italian atheists, they have their starting point. Italian culture with a strong Catholic Church is like, we can't get out of ourselves. We can reach to truth in a reasonable way, yes, of course. But we have to start where we are. And the atheists, they still believe in this Enlightenment idea that they are kind of outside of everything. Looking into it with an objective reason and so on. They have to be reminded of all their... There is so much self-delusion going on. And this empiricist idea, I used to just say to people, you don't believe only what you've experienced. When was your birthday? You know, when were you... You know, it's like, you believe that on authority. Do you believe the sun... That we revolve around the sun? Have you calculated that yourself? No, it's on authority. Most of what you count as knowledge is authority beliefs. But you just don't want to see that. So, I mean, pointing at those kind of things, helping these atheists to get a sound self-knowledge about their view, I think that's immensely important. I think this is just one flow out of this self-delusion that the burden of proof is on the atheist. I think we could help by this argument and asking these questions. We could really challenge the atheists and give good arguments to believers like this. Yes, yes.
Could I suggest, you refer to phenomenology and you say it's not phenomenological, historical.
Yeah.
From Husse. But you describe how things appear to us.
Yes.
It seems this is the point that, for example, Heidegger attacked in its paper on 1957 on ontology.
Yes.
Appear different things to us, the metaphysical of presence. There are things, there are also the there are beings, there are the being of God appear to us.
Yeah.
And he asked, how entered God in philosophy? And this is a really important point for European atheism, because if things appear things a God, that means that things a God are all on the same scale of beings, and there is not the ontological difference. So could be not phenomenology, but common sense, maybe.
Yeah, but I want to emphasize the phenomenon as we experience it. And it doesn't say anything about if it's real, the ontological status behind it. It's a starting point. It's because if you say common sense, it very easily become, the atheist would say atheism is common sense. That term is too broad, I think. If you say phenomenology, you will help the atheist to actually look at the phenomenon, the raw experience, because there you have to find a starting point. So I think it's a helpful idea, nevertheless. Yes, Bill.
I loved your many counterexamples, like there are no fish in Loch Ness, mm-hmm. and others.
Yeah.
But under your third point,
yes.
The one who believes in the world plus God believes in something extra than the person who just believes in the world, and therefore there's a differential burden of proof. I didn't hear any of these charming counterexamples.
No.
So I want to think of one for you.
Oh, great. Today. Yes.
How about using this? We all believe that life exists on Earth. Does the person who believes there is extraterrestrial life therefore have a special burden of proof compared to the person who says there is no extraterrestrial life?
Yeah.
I think clearly either claim would be one requiring a burden of proof. So we both all agree there's life on Earth, but there's no differential burden of proof for the person who says there's extraterrestrial life and the person who says there is no extraterrestrial life.
So the plus thing would be the UFO here.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It would be the extraterrestrial life, that somewhere out in the universe there's life out
it's
there.
It's a good illustration because it's extraterrestrial.
Yeah, right. And it has a common starting
point. Yes, yes, yes.
The other point I wanted to make Do you think that it's worth making the point in this paper anywhere, and I'm not sure you did make it, that on this redefinition of atheism as sort of atheism, as I would put it,
yeah,
that atheism becomes non-truth evaluable? It's just a description of a personal psychological state, and therefore cannot be either true or false, which sort of trivializes position of atheism. Yeah. It's just
discussing
psychological description. It's not
no,
evaluable.
That's right,
it's
because they're very radical. They say there is no beliefs in that stance, it seems. Yeah. Well, then there's no truth value to it. Then how can you enter into a discussion? That's more like you're part of the audience then.
He could enter into discussion in attacking your arguments, but he wouldn't be making any claim as you say it's not even truth evaluable.
But you could also say, but how could he even understand my argument if he doesn't have any beliefs about the conclusion?
Wait, now he does believe your conclusion is false, right?
Well, but
well, no, he doesn't believe it's false.
No.
He doesn't believe it's false, does he? He just believes you haven't justified it.
It's really hard to know what negative atheism really is.
Well, it seems to me it's just a psychological belief state. It's just
but it's the lack of beliefs about God.
Yeah.
So if you don't have any beliefs about the concept of God or anything like that, I mean, how could you even understand what they're talking about? If I were to talk about the Grafunk, you know, I had a discussion about it, and I gave some arguments for the Grafunk.
An atheist can understand the concepts, right, of God and everything, but
he doesn't
have any belief about whether God exists or not. He lacks belief.
He doesn't have any beliefs, yeah, but then, on the other hand, if you have a concept and you understand the concept...
But you can have other mental states.
You can have other mental states, maybe. Preposition, yeah.
But saying that it lacks beliefs is...
Then how could it have truth value? Yeah, that seems very strange.
It would be more like a defiance.
Yeah, Peter.
But whilst we're talking about giving the putative atheist some concepts at least to work with, let's leave the ontological argument in here. And then they surely have to have some belief whether it's possible for such a being
to exist or not.
So then they can't be an atheist, and particularly for that category that you mentioned, those who say one of their arguments for their burden of proof distribution was the claim that you can't prove a universal negative. For those people, they couldn't combine that approach with any argument against God from the logical problem of evil, which attempts to prove a universal negative, or any arguments against God from the incoherence of the concept of God, which try to do the same. So where would that leave their atheism?
You know, I think this is much rhetoric, actually. I think it's rhetoric, basically. But it is persuasive rhetoric if you haven't thought about it.
Yeah.
So, and that's, I think, where we can come into the picture and help sorting out things. But I don't know. Maybe it's my pride, but as far as I can see, this argument that I lays out is conclusive, or as nearly conclusive as you can get, almost. I mean, the whole idea of the burden of proof is just wrong here. And I'm amazed that the atheist that I've talked about earlier, he read this, and he would still claim his thing.
Oh.
It's just that he doesn't understand it, I get. Yes?
I was just thinking about the courtroom scenario. I mean, if you've ever been on the jury, which I have, where it's an unfortunate experience, where the judge tells you, 12 of you, that you, in order to come to the right conclusion, you have to be totally sure, so that you then vote on the decision to make. You vote, and it may be 10 to, he may say it has to be 10 to 2, or he may say it has to be 7 to 3, or something like that, 7 to 5, or something like that, but he will dictate. And I was wondering whether the dictation of this kind of criteria is to do with the culture. So for the atheists, or for our culture, they decide who has to have the burden of proof, in a way. So we are kind of left in that situation where we have to prove, and they don't.
It's a cultural power play going on here, I would say. Because if the culture feels that we have the burden of proof, in a sense, we have. But on the other hand, you know, we could just counteract that power play by saying stuff like, well, but it's only 3% of the population of the world that have your belief. So we're the majority. We believe in gods or God or something spiritual. You have to prove your point. Look at history. Human beings have believed this stuff. You're the new kid on the block. You have to prove your point. You know, we could just, we could actually make up some rhetorical arguments that are maybe not so good, but they are still true, and they might make the point that we can justify more deeply in arguments like these. But that's what I'm saying. It's a lot of psychology going in here. We will continue, and no one leaves this room without putting evaluations here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And while you can.